By way of Ziadur Custom House, early summer, 1004 CE. Dearest Uncle Nicolaes, forgive me for not writing for some time. Duties in upper household keep me occupied and seldom allowed to go anywhere without a chaperone. Inish Court concerns itself most deeply with the private time of its young ladies. I pray this reaches Ostenda before the next shipment eastward. I do bid you send me word how that you do in Orissima. Have been occupying myself in the meantime with remembering the books you left to me, which are presently held in the silk hall. I believe I have a theory, and am certain the significance of a certain object has been overlooked. Will you write with all you know of the tablet of Rumalabar? Have you an answer to its riddle? All my love, Trude. Note to Ziadur Custom House. I would appreciate your due haste in conferring this to Ostender Port Authority. Regards, your Marchioness. Nicolaes read the words again, half smiling, eyes hot. He was supposed to have received this letter long before Sulliard arrived. She might have warned him to expect the boy, but Lord Satan Combe, the spy master of Innis, would have seen through any code. He had sent replies to her earlier letters, but he suspected they had been destroyed. Exiles were not permitted to write home. Even if he had been able to reach her, he had no good tidings. That evening, Perume and Izaru took him to the river to spot night-flying herons. The day after, Nicolaes elected to keep to his room and ice his ankle. While he nursed an excitement-induced headache, he found himself thinking of Sulliard. He ought to feel shame for enjoying himself while the boy rotted in jail, especially when he believed that Nicolaes was finishing his quest for him, a quest based on an unsolved riddle and the dangerous passion Trude had inherited from Janart. A passion for truth. A riddle that now refused to leave Nicolaes alone. At midday, he asked the servants for a writing box and painted out the words, just so he could see them on the page. What is below must be balanced by what is above, and in this is the precision of the universe. Fire ascends from the earth, light descends from the sky. Too much of one doth inflame the other, and in this is the extinction of the universe. Nicolaes thought back to what he had learned about the riddle at university. It was from the Tablet of Rumalabar, found many centuries ago in the Saras Mountains. Assyri miners had discovered a subterranean temple in those mountains. Stars had been carved on its ceiling, flaming trees onto its floor. A block of skystone had stood at its heart, and the words scored into it, written in the script of the first southern civilization, had captivated academic minds the world over. Nicolaes underlined one part of the riddle and contemplated its meaning. Fire ascends from the earth.
Worms, perhaps.
The Nameless One and his followers were said to have come from the womb of fire in the core of the world. He underlined again. Light descends from the sky, the meteor shower, the one that had ended the grief of ages, weakened the worms, and granted strength to the eastern dragons. Too much of one doth inflame the other, and in this is the extinction of the universe. A warning of disparity. This theory posited the universe as yoked to the balance of fire and starlight, weighed on a set of cosmic scales. Too much of either would tip them. The extinction of the universe. The closest the world had ever come to ending was the arrival of the Nameless One and his followers. Had some sort of imbalance in the universe created these beasts of fire? The sun beat hard on the back of his head. He found himself drowsing. When Izaru woke him, his cheek was stuck to the parchment, and he felt as heavy as a sack of millet.
"Good afternoon, my friend," Izaru chuckled. "Were you working on something?"
"Izaru," clearing his throat, Nicolaes peeled himself free. "No, no, merely a trifle."
"I see. Well," Izaru said, "if you are finished, I wondered if you might like to come with me into the city. The fisherfolk have bought a haul of silver crab from the unending sea, but it sells out quickly at the market. You must try it before you return to Orissima."
"I fondly hope that I never will return to Orissima."
His friend hesitated.
"Izaru," Nicolaes said, wary. "What is it?"
Izaru reached into his robe, tight-lipped, and pulled out and handed him a scroll. The seal was broken, but Nicolaes could see it belonged to the Viceroy of Orissima.
"I received this today," Izaru said. "After your audience with the All-Honored Warlord, you are to return to Orissima.
A palanquin will collect you. Suddenly the scroll weighed more than a boulder. It might have been his death warrant. Do not despair, Nicolas. Izaru laid a hand on his shoulder. The honored Queen Sabram will relent. Until then, Perume and I will seek permission to visit you in Orisima. It took Nicolas all his strength to swallow his disappointment. It went down like a mouthful of thorns. That would be wonderful. He dredged up a smile. Come, then. I suppose I had better enjoy the city while I can. Perume was absorbed in setting a bone, so once he was dressed, Nicolas set out alone with Izaru to the fish market. The sea lashed a stinging wind across the city, fogging his eyeglasses, and in his jaundiced state, the gazes he received seemed more suspicious than ever. As they passed a robe shop, its owner scowled at him. Sickness, Bera, she snapped. Nicolas was too downcast to respond. Izaru directed a stern look at the woman over his eyeglasses, and she turned away. In the moment his attention was diverted, Nicolas trod on a booted foot. He heard an intake of breath. Izaru clutched him in time to break his fall, but the young Sykenese woman whose foot he had squashed was not so fortunate. Her elbow knocked into a vase which shattered on the paving stones. Damn it all, it was like an elephant in a tea house. "Excuse me, honourable lady," Nicolas said and bowed deep. "I was not paying attention." The merchant stared glumly at the shards. Slowly, the woman turned to face Nicolas. Black hair was wrapped into a knot at the crown of her head. She wore pleated trousers, a tunic of deep blue silk, and a velvet surcoat. A fine sword hung at her side. When he saw the sheen on the tunic, Nicolas was unable to stop his mouth popping open. Unless he was mistaken, that was water silk. Erroneously named, it was not a silk at all, but hair. The mane hair of dragons, to be precise. It repelled moisture like oil. The woman took a step towards him. Her face was angular and brown, her lips chapped. Dancing pearls adorned her throat. But what seared itself into his memory, in the few moments their gazes held, was the scar. It whipped across her left cheekbone before curling towards the corner of her eye, exactly like a fish hook. "Outsider," she murmured. Nicolas realized that the crowd around them had fallen almost silent. The back of his neck prickled. He had the sense that he had just committed a greater transgression than blundering. "Honorable citizen, what is this man doing in Genura?" the woman asked Izaru curtly. "He should be in Orisima with the other Mentish settlers." "Honored Medushi," Izaru bowed. "We humbly apologize for interrupting your day. This is the learned Dr. Roos, an anatomist of the Free State of Mentendon. He is here to see the all-honored warlord." The woman cut her gaze between them. There was a rawness in her eyes that spoke of disturbed nights. "What is your name?" she asked Izaru. "Moyaka Izaru, honored Medushi." "Do not let this man out of your sight, honorable Moyaka. He must always have an escort, I understand." She tossed Nicolas a final look before she strode away. As she turned, he caught sight of a golden dragon at the back of her jacket. She had long dark hair and a scar at the top of her left cheek, like a fish hook. By the saint, it had to be her. Izaru paid the merchant for his loss and hurried Nicolas into a cobbled lane. "Who was that, Izaru?" Nicolas asked in Mentish. "The honored Lady Tane. She is Medushi, rider of the great Nyarlathotep of the Deep Snows." Izaru dabbed his neck with a cloth. "I should have bowed lower. I will repay you for the vase at some point." "It's only a few coins, Nicolas. The knowledge you gave me in Orisima is worth far more." Izaru, Nicolas decided, was as close as anyone could get to being flawless. The two of them reached the fish market in the nick of time. Silver crabs spilled from nets of wheat straw, gleaming like the steel armour of knights. Nicolas almost lost Izaru in the ensuing scramble, but his friend emerged triumphant, his eyeglasses askew. It was almost sunset by the time they got back to the house. Nicolas feigned another headache and retreated to his room, where he sat beside the lantern and rubbed his brow. He had always prided himself on his brain, but it had been idle of late. It was high time to set it to work.
Tane Madushi was, without question, the woman Sulliard had seen on the beach. Her scar betrayed her. She had brought an outsider into Cape Hassan on that fateful night, and then handed him over to a musician who was now languishing in prison, or headless. The bobtail cat jumped into his lap, purring. Nicolay's absently scratched between its ears. The Great Edict required islanders to report trespassers to the authorities without delay. Madushi should have done that. Why, instead, had she enlisted a friend to hide him in the Mentish trading post? When he realized, Nicolay let out such a loud ha that the cat sprang off his lap in fright. The bells! The bells had been ringing the next day, heralding the ceremony that would open the way for Madushi to become a dragon rider. If an outsider had been discovered in Cape Hassan the night before, the port would have been closed to ensure there was no trace of the red sickness. Madushi had hidden Sulliard in Orisima, isolated from the rest of the city, so as not to disturb the ceremony. She had put her ambition above the law. Nicolay's weighed his options. Sulliard had agreed to tell his questioners about the woman with the fishhook scar. Perhaps he had, but no one had realized who it was, or taken a trespasser at his word. Nicolay's, however, was protected by the alliance between Psyche and Mentendon. That had shielded him against punishment before, and it might just aid him now. He might still save Sulliard. If he could muster the courage to accuse Madushi during his audience with the warlord, before witnesses, the House of Nadama would have to act upon it, or risk appearing to dismiss their Mentish trading partners. Nicolay's was quite sure there was some way to turn this to his advantage, if only he knew what it was. Purume came home at nightfall with bloodshot eyes, and the servants prepared the silver crab with fine-cut vegetables and rice, steamed with chestnuts. The flaky white meat was delectable, but Nicolay's was too deep in thought to appreciate it. When they were finished, Purume retired, while Nicolay stayed at the table with Aizaru. "My friend," Nicolay said, "please pardon me if this is an ignorant question." "Only ignorant men do not ask questions." Nicolay's cleared his throat. "This dragon rider, Lady Tane," he began, "from what I can tell, the riders are almost as esteemed as the dragons. Is that correct?" His friend considered this for a time. "They are not gods," he said. "There are no shrines in their honor, but they are revered. The all-honored warlord is descended from a rider who fought in the Great Sorrow, as you know. The dragons see their riders as their equals among humankind, which is the greatest honor." "With that in mind," Nicolay said, trying to sound casual, "if you knew that one of them had committed a crime, what would you do?"
"If I knew, beyond all possible doubt, that it was true, I would report it to their commander, the honored sea general, at Saltflower Castle."
Aizaru tilted his head. "Why do you ask, my friend? Do you believe one of them has committed a crime?" Nicolay smiled to himself. "No, Aizaru," he said. "I was only speculating." He changed the subject.
"I have heard that the moat around Ginnura Castle is full of fish with bodies like glass, that when they glow at night you can see right the way to their bones. Tell me, is that true?"
He did love the delicious onset of a good idea.
Tane found a foothold and pushed with all her strength, reaching for an overhang. Beneath her, the sea crashed against a smattering of rocks. She was halfway up the volcanic stack that rose from the sea at the mouth of Ginnura Bay. It was called the Grieving Orphan, for it stood alone, like a child whose parents had been shipwrecked. As her fingertips touched stone, her other hand slipped on sea moss. Her stomach lurched. For a moment she thought she would fall and shatter every bone. Then she shoved herself upwards, snatched the overhang, and clung to it like a barnacle. With a last tremendous effort, she got onto the ledge above and lay there, breathing hard. It had been reckless to climb without her gloves, but she had wanted to prove to herself that she could. Her mind kept returning to that Ment in the street, and the way he had stared at her, as if he had recognized her. It was impossible, of course. She had never seen him before. But why that look of shock? He was a large man, wide in the shoulders, broad in the chest, paunchy in the stomach, eyes like clove hooded with age, set in a sallow and blunt-edged face. Grey hair that held glints of copper, a mouth with a history of laughter etched around it. Round eyeglasses. Bruce. Finally it came to her. Bruce, a name Sousa had whispered to her so briefly it had almost been carried away by the wind. He was the one who had hidden the outsider. There was no reason he should be in Genura, not unless he was here to testify about that night. The thought locked her chest. She recalled his perceptive look in the street, and it sent a shudder through her. With a clenched jaw, she stretched towards the next handhold. Whatever Roos thought he knew about her or Sousa, he had no proof, and the outsider would be dead by now. When she reached the top, she stood, palms bloody. The water silks worked like feathers. One quick shake and they were dry. She could see the whole of Genura from here. Saltflower Castle shone in the last of the sunlight. The dragon awaited her in a natural shelter. Her true name was impossible for humans to pronounce, so she was known to them as Naimathan. Hatched long ago in the Lake of Deep Snows, she now bore countless scars from the Great Sorrow. Every night, Tane would climb to the shelter and sit beside her dragon until the sun rose. It was just as she had always dreamed. Talking had been hard at first. Naimathan would not hear of Tane using the sort of respectful language that befitted a god. They were to be as kin, she said, as sisters. Anything else and they would not be able to fly together. Dragon and rider had to share one heart. Tane had not known how to cope with this rule. All her life she had spoken to her elders with respect, and now a god wished for them to speak as if they were the closest of friends. Gradually, haltingly, she had told the dragon about her childhood in Ampiki, the fire that had taken her parents, and her years of training in the South House. Naimathan had listened, patiently. Now, as the ocean swallowed the sun, Tane walked barefoot to the dragon, whose head was curled against her neck. The position reminded Tane of a sleeping duck. She knelt beside Naimathan and placed a hand flat on her scales. Dragons did not hear in quite the same way as humans did. Touch helped them to feel the vibrations of a voice.
Good evening, Naimathan.
Tane. Naimathan half opened one eye. Sit with me. Her voice was war conch and whale song, and the distant rumble of a storm, all smoothed into words like glass shaped by the sea. Listening to it made Tane drowsy. She sat down and leaned against the ever-damp scales of her dragon. They were wonderfully cool. Naimathan sniffed.
You are wounded.
Blood was still leaking from her hand. Tane closed it. Only a little, she said. I left in haste and forgot my gloves.
No need for haste, small one. The night is newborn.
A rattling breath passed through the dragon, right down the length of her body.
I thought we might talk about stars.
Tane looked at the sky, where tiny eyes of silver were starting to peer out. Stars, Naimathan.
Yes. Do they teach the lore of stars in your houses of learning?
A little.
In the South House, our teachers told us the names of the constellations and how to find our way with them. Tane hesitated. In the village I was born in, they say stars are the spirits of people who fled from the Nameless One. They climbed up ladders and hid in the heavens to await the day when every fire breather lies dead in the sea.
Villagers can be wiser than scholars. Naimathan looked down at her. You are my rider now, Tane. You are therefore entitled to the knowledge of my kind.
Not one of her teachers had ever told her this would happen.
It would be my honor to receive it, she said.
Naimathan turned her gaze skyward. Her eyes grew brighter, as if they were mirrors for the moon.
Starlight, she said, is what birthed us. All dragons of the East came first from the heavens.
As she sat beside the dragon, Tane admired her bright horns, the fringe of spines beneath her jaw, and her crown, blue as a fresh bruise. That was the organ that allowed her to fly. Naimathan saw her looking.
That part of me marks the place where my ancestors fell from the stars and struck their heads against the seabed, she said.
I thought...
Tane wet her lips.
Naimathan, forgive me, but I thought dragons came from eggs.
She knew they did. Eggs like clouded glass, smooth and wet, each with an iridescent shine. They could sit for centuries in water before a dragon wriggled out as a tiny, fragile being. Still,
Questioning a god made her voice quake.
Now? Yes, Nyamathan said. But it was not always so.
She raised her head to face the sky again.
Our ancestors came from the comet you call Quiddicky's Lantern, before there were any children of the flesh. It rained light into the water, and from that water dragonkind came forth.
Tane stared at her.
But, Nyamathan, she said, how can a comet make a dragon?
It leaves behind a substance, molten starlight that falls into the sea and the lakes. As to how the substance grew into dragons, that is knowledge I do not possess. The comet comes from the celestial plane, and I have yet to occupy it. When the comet passes, Nyamathan continued, we are at full strength. We lay eggs and they hatch, and we regain every gift that we once possessed. But slowly our strength fades, and we must await the next coming of the comet to return it.
Is there no other way to regain your strength?
Nyamathan looked at her with those ancient eyes. Tane felt very small under her gaze.
Other dragons may not share this with their riders, Medushi Tane, she rumbled. But I will make you a gift of another piece of knowledge. Thank you.
Shivers twitched through her. Surely no one living was worthy of so much wisdom from a god.
The comet ended the great sorrow, but it has come to this world many times before, Nyamathan said. Once, many moons ago, it left behind two celestial jewels, each infused with its power, solid fragments of itself. With them, our ancestors could control the waves. Their presence allowed us to hold on to our strength for longer than we could before. But they have been lost for almost 1,000 years.
Sensing the sadness in the dragon, Tane stripped a hand over her scales. Though they gleamed like the scales of a fish, they were hatched with scars, rent by teeth and horns.
How were such precious objects lost? She asked.
Nyamathan let out the softest rattle through her teeth.
Almost 1,000 years ago, a human used them to fold the sea over the Nameless One, she said. That was how he was defeated. After that, the two jewels passed out of history, as if they never were.
Tane shook her head. A human? She repeated. She remembered the legends from the West. Was he called Berethnet?
No, it was a woman of the East.
They sat in silence. Water dripped from the rock above their heads.
We had many ancient powers once, Tane,
Nyamathan said.
We could shed our skin like snakes and change our forms. You have heard the Cycones legend of Quiddicky and the snow-walking maiden?
Yes. Tane had heard it many times in the South House. It was one of the oldest stories in Psyche. Long ago, when they had first emerged from the waves, the dragons of the Sundance Sea had agreed among themselves to befriend the children of the flesh, whose fires they had seen on a nearby beach. They had brought them gifts of golden fish to show their good intent, but the islanders, suspicious and afraid, threw spears at the dragons, and they disappeared sadly to the depths of the sea, not to be seen again for years. One young woman, however, had witnessed the coming of the dragons and mourned their absence. Every day, she would wander into the great forest and sing of her sorrow for the beautiful creatures that had come to the island for such a brief time. In the story, she had no name, like too many women in the stories of old. She was only Snow Walking Maiden. One bitter morning, Snow Walking Maiden came across a wounded bird in a stream. She mended its wing and fed it with drops of milk. After a year in her care, the bird grew strong, and she carried it to the cliffs to let it fly away. That was when the bird had transformed into Quiddicky, the great elder, who had been wounded at sea and taken a new form to escape. Snow Walking Maiden was filled with joy, and so was the great Quiddicky, for he knew now that the children of the flesh had good in them. To thank Snow Walking Maiden for caring for him, the great Quiddicky carved her a throne out of his own horn, which was called the Rainbow Throne, and made her a handsome consort night-dancing prince out of sea foam. Snow Walking Maiden became the first Empress of Psyche, and she flew over the island with the great Quirky, teaching the people to love the dragons and harm them no more. Her bloodline had ruled Psyche until they had perished in the Great Sorrow, and the first warlords had taken up arms to avenge them.
The story is true. Quirky did take the form of a bird. With time, we could learn to take many shapes, Nyarlathotep said. We could change our size, weave illusions, bestow dreams. Such was our power. But no longer.
Tane listened to the sea below. She imagined herself as a conch, carrying that roar in her belly. As her eyelids grew heavier, Nyarlathotep looked down at her.
Something troubles you.
Tane tensed. No, she said. I was just thinking how happy I am. I have everything I ever wanted. Nyarlathotep rumbled, and mist puffed from her nostrils.
There is nothing you cannot tell me.
Tane could not meet her gaze. Every grain of her being told her not to lie in the presence of a god, but she could not tell the truth about the outsider. For that crime, her dragon would cast her aside. She would sooner die than have that happen. I know, was all she said. The pupil of the dragon's eye grew to a pool of darkness. Tane could see her own face inside it.
I meant to fly you back to the castle, Nyarlathotep said.
But I must rest tonight.
I understand. A low growl rolled through Nyarlathotep. She spoke as if to herself.
He is stirring. The shadow lies heavy on the west.
Who is stirring? The dragon closed her eyes and lowered her head back onto her neck.
Stay with me until sunrise, Tane.
Of course. Tane lay by her side. Nyarlathotep shifted closer and coiled around her.
Sleep, she said. The stars will watch over us.
Her body shut out the wind. As Tane drowsed against the dragon she had always dreamed about, lulled by her heartbeat, she had the curious sense that she was in the womb again. She also had the sense that something was closing in on her, like a net around a writhing fish. Chapter 26 West. News of the royal progress to Ascalon spread across Innis, from the Bay of the Balefire to the misty cliff-lined reaches of the Fells. After 14 long years, Queen Sebran would show herself to the people of the capital, and the capital prepared to welcome her. Before Eid knew it, the day was upon them. As she dressed, she concealed her blades. Two went beneath her skirts, another she tucked behind her stomacher, a fourth into one of her boots. The ornamental dagger, carried by all ladies of the bedchamber, was the only one she could display. At 5 o'clock, she joined Catrian in the royal apartments and went with her to rouse Sebran and Roslane. For her first public appearance since the coronation, the ladies-in-waiting had to make the queen more than beautiful. They had to make her divine. She was arrayed in midnight velvet, a girdle of carnelians, and a stole of Bodmin fur, making her stand out against the bronze-tinseled satin and brown furs around her. This way she would evoke memories of Queen Rosarion, who had loved to wear blue. A sword-shaped brooch was pinned to her bodice. She alone, in all virtudom, took the saint himself as her patron. Roslane, whose hair was adorned with amber and cranberry glass, took charge of choosing the jewels. Eid picked up a comb. Holding Sebran by the shoulder, she grazed its teeth through the cascade of black hair until each lock glided between her fingers. Sebran stood like a stanchion. Her eyes were raw with sleeplessness. Eid gentled her brushing. Sebran tilted her head into her touch. With each stroke of the comb, her stance lost some of its tension, and the cast of her jaw softened. As she worked, Eid set her fingertips on the naked place behind Sebran's ear, holding her still. "You look very beautiful today, Eid," Sebran said. It was the first time she had spoken since rising. Your Majesty is kind to say so, Eid teased a stubborn knot. Are you looking forward to your visit to the city? Sebran did not answer for some time. Eid kept combing.
I look forward to seeing my people, Sabran finally said. My father always encouraged me to walk among them, but I could not. She must be thinking of her mother, the reason she had seen little but the gleaming interiors of her palaces for 14 years. I wish I could tell them I am with child. She touched her jewel-encrusted stomacher. The royal physician has advised me to wait until my daughter quickens. What they desire is to see you, whether your belly is big or not, he had said. In any case, you will be able to tell them in a few weeks, and think how pleased they will be then. The queen studied her face. Then, quite unexpectedly, she took her by the hand. Tell me, Iad, she said, how is it you always know what to say to comfort me? Before Iad could answer, Rosalind approached. Iad stepped away, and Sabran's hand slipped from hers, but she still felt the ghost of it against her palm. Its fine spun bones, the scallops of her knuckles. Sabran let her ladies guide her to the washbasin. Catrian took charge of reddening her lips, while Iad braided 6 sections of her hair and wound them into a rosette at the back of her head, leaving the rest loose and waving. Last came a silver crown. Once she was ready, the queen beheld herself in the glass. Rosalind straightened the crown. "Just one last touch," she said, and slipped a necklace around Sabran's throat. Graduated sapphires and pearls, and a pendant shaped like a seahorse. You remember? Of course. Sabran traced the pendant, her expression distant. My mother gave it to me. Rosalind placed a hand on her shoulder. Let her be with you now. She would be so proud. The Queen of Innis studied the glass a moment longer. Finally, she gathered her breath and turned. My ladies, she said, with a faint smile, how do I look? Catrian tucked a strand of hair into her crown and nodded. Like the blood of the saint, your majesty. By 10 o'clock, the sky was blinding in its blueness. The ladies-in-waiting escorted Sabran to the gates of Briar House, where Albrechtly Evelyn was waiting in a great cloak with the 6 dukes spiritual. Satan Combe, as usual, had a clement smile on his lips. He had itched to swipe it away. He might look pleased with himself, but he had clearly made no progress on the matter of the cutthroats. Neither, to her frustration, had Iad. Much as she wanted to investigate, her duties left her with so little time. If the killers were to strike again, it would be today. While Sabran was given a hand into the royal coach, Igraine Crest held out a hand to her granddaughter.
Rosalind, she said, smiling. How lovely you are today, child, the jewel of my world.
Oh, grandmother, you are too generous, Rosalind curtsied and kissed her on the cheek. Good day.
We can only hope it will be a good day, Lady Rosalind, Lord Richard Ella muttered. I mislike the Queen walking among the commons. Everything will be fine, Combe said. His livery collar reflected the sunlight. Her Majesty and His Royal Highness are well protected, are they not, Sir Tharian?
Never more so than they will be today, Your Grace, Lintley said with a smart bow.
Ella
looked unconvinced.
Very good, Sir Tharian.
Iad shared a coach with Rosalind and Catrian. As they trundled away from the palace into the thick of the city, she gazed out of the window. Ascalon was the first and only capital of Innis. Its cobbled streets were home to thousands of people from all corners of Virtudom and beyond. Before Galleon had returned to these isles, they had been a patchwork of ever-warring territories, ruled by a surfeit of overlords and princelings. Galleon had united them all under one crown, his crown. The capital he built, named after his sword, was said to have been a paradise once. Now it was as rife with knavery and filth as any other city. Most of the buildings were stone. After the grief of ages, when fire had raged across Innis, a law had been passed to ban thatched roofs. Only a handful of wooden houses, designed by Rosarian II, had been allowed to remain for their beauty. Dark timberwork arranged in opulent designs formed a striking contrast to the white of their filling. The richer wards were rich indeed. Queenside boasted 50 goldsmiths and twice as many silversmiths. Hen Street was for workshops, where inventors devised new weapons to defend Innis. On the Isle of Nels, Pounce Lane was good for poets and playwrights. Brazen Alley for booksellers.
Goods from elsewhere in the world were sold at the great market in Wellard Square. Bright Lassian copper and ceramic and gold jewellery, Mentish paintings and marquetry and salt-glazed pottery, rare cranberry glass from the old Serene Republic of Carmentum, perfume burners and skystone from Ursir. In the poorer wards the royal party would visit today, like Kine End and Setz, life was less beautiful. In these wards were the shambles, the brothels, disguised as inns to avoid the order of sanctarians, and alehouses where footpads counted stolen coin. Tens of thousands of Inish were out in force, waiting for a glimpse of their queen. The sight of them struck disquiet into Eird. There had been no cutthroats since the marriage, but she was certain the threat had not yet diminished. The royal procession stopped outside the sanctuary of Our Lady, which was believed to house the tomb of Cleolind. Eird knew that it did not. It was the highest building in Innis, taller even than the Alabastrine Tower, made of pale stone that shone beneath the sun. Eird stepped from the coach into the light. It had been a long time since she had walked the streets of Ascalon, but she knew them well. Before Chasar had presented her to Sabran, she had spent a month learning every vein and sinew of the city, so she could find her way if she ever had to flee from court. A concourse had gathered at the steps of the sanctuary, hungry for attention from their sovereign. They had scattered queen flower and jewel lilies over the cobblestone. While the maids of honour and the extraordinary chamberers emerged from their coaches with Olivia marching, Eird took stock of the crowd. "I don't see Lady Trude," she said to Catrian. "She has a headache." Catrian pursed her lips. "A fine day for it." Margaret came to stand beside them. "I expected a great many people," she said, breath clouding. "But by the saint, I think the whole city has come." She nodded to the royal coach. "Here we go." Eird braced herself. When Leavlin emerged, the Innish cheered as if the saint himself had returned. Unfazed, he raised a hand in greeting before extending it to Sabran, who climbed out with poise. The roar of the crowd grew so loud, so fast, that it seemed to Eird to transcend sound and attain a physicality. It wrenched out her breath and dealt a blow to her insides. She felt Catrian shiver with exhilaration beside her and saw Margaret stare, as the Innish went to their knees before their queen. Hats were removed, tears were shed, and she thought the cheers would lift the sanctuary of Our Lady from the ground. Sabran stood like one stricken by a thunderbolt. Eird watched her take it all in. Since the day she was crowned, she had hidden in her palaces. She had forgotten what she was to her people, the living embodiment of hope, their shield and their salvation. She recovered quickly. Though she did not wave, she smiled and joined hands with Leavlin. They remained side by side for a time and allowed their subjects to adore them. Captain Lintley walked first, one hand resting on his basket-hilted sword. The Knights of the Body and some 300 guards, posted along the route they would take, had been mustered to protect the Queen and the Prince Consort on their tour of the city. As she followed Sabran, Eird watched the crowd, her gaze darting from face to face, hand to hand. No good killer would ignore an opportunity like this. The sanctuary of Our Lady was as magnificent inside as it was on the exterior, with a vaulted ceiling. Trefoil windows towered, scattering the party with splinters of purple light. The guards waited outside. Sabran and Leavlin walked towards the tomb. It was a stately block of marble, set into an alcove behind the altar. The damsel was thought to rest, incorrupt, in a locked vault beneath it. There was no effigy. The royal couple knelt on the hassocks in front of it and bowed their heads. After a while, Leavlin stepped back to allow Sabran to say a prayer in private. The ladies of the bedchamber came to kneel around her. "Blessed damsel," Sabran said to the tomb, "I am Sabran the Ninth. Mine is your crown, mine is your queendom, and every day I long to bring glory to the house of Berethnet. I long to be possessed of your compassion, your courage, and your forbearance." She closed her eyes, and her voice became a ghost of breath. "I confess," she said, "that I am not much like you. I have been impatient and arrogant. For too long I forswore my duty to this realm, refusing to gift unto my people a princess, and instead sought errant means of prolonging my own life." Eird glanced at her. The queen took off her fur-trimmed glove and laid her hand upon the marble. She was praying to an empty tomb.
I ask you this as your loving scion. Let me carry my daughter to term. Let her be hale and spirited. Let me give the people of Virtudom hope. I will do anything for this. I will die to give my daughter life. I will sacrifice all else for her, but let our house not end with me. Her voice was steady, but her face was an ode to fatigue. Eard considered, then reached for her. At first, Sobran stiffened. A moment later, she twined their fingers and held on. No woman should be made to fear that she was not enough. When Sobran rose, so did her ladies. Eard steeled herself. The next part of the journey would be the most dangerous. Sobran and Lievelin were to meet the unfortunate of Ascalon and give them purses of gold. As they descended the steps of the sanctuary, Sobran stayed close to her companion. The party would go on foot from here. They followed Berethnet Mile through the city, flanked by city guards. Halfway down it, they crossed Marion Square, and a tinker called, "Get her with child or get back to Mentendon!" Lievelin remained impassive, but Sobran clenched her jaw. As the man was dragged away by the guards, she took Lievelin by the hand. To reach Kine End, they had to pass through the ward of Sulven by the river, where the streets were shaded by evergreens, and the Carnelian Theatre loomed over the stalls. The noise was thunderous, the air heady with excitement. As Sobran paused to admire a bolt of cloth, something made Eard glance towards the bakehouse across the street. Crouched on its balcony was a figure, with a rag over his nose and mouth. As Eard watched, he raised his arm. A pistol gleamed in the sunlight.
"Death to the House of Berethnet!"
he shouted. It was as if time slowed. Sobran looked up sharply, and someone let out a cry of horror, but Eard was already there. She collided with Sobran and hooked an arm around her waist, and they dropped to the cobblestones as the pistol discharged with a sound like the world splitting. Screams erupted from the crowd as an old man buckled, hit by the bullet meant for the queen. Eard landed hard on her hip, curled around Sobran, who clutched her in return, one arm crossed over her belly. Eard scooped her up and handed her to Lievelin. He wheeled her away from the direction of the gunfire.
"The queen!" Captain Lintley bellowed. "All swords to the queen!"
"Up there!" Eard pointed. "Kill him!" The shooter had already hurdled to the next balcony. Lintley took aim with his crossbow, but the quarrel missed by an inch. He cursed and loaded another. Eard put herself in front of Sobran. Lievelin drew his broadsword and guarded her back. The other ladies-in-waiting fanned out around their queen. As her gaze shadowed the shooter, who was now leaping like an antelope between rooftops, Eard grew cold all over. She looked to the other side of the street. They did not wear vizards, not like the cutthroats in the palace. Instead, their faces were hidden by plague masks, the sort physicians had used to protect themselves in the grief of ages. As the first of them burst out of the crowd and bore down on the royal party, Eard hurled the dagger from her girdle. It hit the nearest attacker in the throat. The crowd splintered. In the chaos, the next attacker was suddenly on top of them.
"Fuck the House of Berethnet!"
he screamed at Sobran. He slammed into one of the knights of the body, who threw him off and thrust her sword at him.
"Hail the Nameless One! The God of the Mountain!"
The invocation went up nearby.
"His kingdom will come!"
Doomsingers. In a heartbeat, Lintley had traded crossbow for sword and cut down the nearest threat. The gallant knight was gone, replaced by a man who had been handpicked to protect the Queen of Innis. The next attacker stopped in her tracks, and when Lintley bore down on her, she turned and fled. A musket fired and blew her guts across the cobblestones. In the chaos, Eard looked for the Nighthawk, but there was too much panic, too many bodies. Sobran stayed rooted in place, fists clenched at her side, unbowed. A preternatural calm descended on Eard. As she drew two blades, she forgot that ladies of the bedchamber were not educated in combat. She let fall the cloak of secrecy she had worn for all these years. All she knew was her duty, to keep Sobran alive. The war dance was calling to her, as it had the first time she had hunted a basilisk. Like wind on fire, she flashed into the next wave of attackers, wheeling her blades, and they fell dead around her. She pulled herself back from the brink. Lintley was staring at her, his face dappled with blood. A scream made his head turn. Lenora? She keened in terror, pleading, as two of the doomsingers wrestled her to the ground. Eard and Lintley both ran towards her at once, but a knife opened her throat, spraying blood,
and it was too late. She was lost.
Ea tried to temper her shock, but bile scalded her gorge. Sobran stared at her dying lady. The knights of the body encircled their queen, but they were surrounded, the threat everywhere. Another masked figure charged at the royals, but Roslane, with a ferocity Ead had never seen in her, thrust her knife into his thigh. A shout came from behind the mask.
"The Nameless One will rise," a voice said, panting. "We pledge our allegiance."
Fog obscured the eyeholes.
"Death to the House of Berethnit!"
Roslane went for his throat, but he smashed his fist into her head, snapping it back. Sobran cried out in anger. Ead pulled out of the fray and ran towards her, just as the knave slashed with a knife at Lievelin, who raised his sword just in time to parry. The tussle that followed was short and violent. Lievelin was the stronger, years of tutelage behind every movement. With one brutal downcut, it was over. Sobran backed away from the corpse. Her companion beheld his own sword and swallowed. Blood dripped from its blade.
"Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness, follow me!"
A knight of the body had broken free of the fray. His copper-plated armor was redder than before.
"I know a safe place in this ward. Captain Lintley commanded me take you hence. We must go now."
Ead pointed one of her knives at him. Most knights of the body wore close helms outdoors, and the voice beneath this one was muffled.
"Come no farther," she said. "Who are you?"
"Sir Grant Lambrin."
"Take off your helm."
"Peace, Mistress Durian. I recognize his voice," the Evelyn said. "It is not safe for Sir Grant to remove his helm."
"Roz!"
Sobran was straining to reach her chief gentlewoman.
"Albrecht, carry her, please."
Ead looked for Margaret and Catrian, but they were nowhere to be seen. Lenora lay in her lake of blood, eyes glazed in death. The Evelyn gathered Roslane into his arms and followed Sir Grant Lambrin, who was rushing Sobran away. Roundly cursing Lievelin for his trust, Ead chased after them. The other knights of the body strove to join their queen, but they were overwhelmed. How had someone orchestrated such a swarm? She caught up to Sobran and Lievelin, just as Lambrin was leading them around a corner, out of sight of Berethnit Mile. He took them through an overgrown charnel garden on Quiver Lane to a sanctuary that had fallen into ruin. He shepherded his royal charges inside, but when he had reached the doors, he barred her way.
"You ought to find the other ladies, mistress.
I will follow the queen, sir," he had said, "or you will not."
Lambrin did not move. She tightened her grip on her knives.
"Ead," Sobran said. "Ead, where are you?"
The knight was as a statue for a moment longer before he stood aside. Once Ead had passed, he sheathed his sword and bolted the doors behind them. When he removed his helm, Ead beheld the ruddy face of Sir Grant Lambrin. He shot her a look of intense dislike. The interior of the sanctuary was as wild as the charnel garden. Weeds fingered through the shattered windows. Roslane lay on the altar, still but for the rise and fall of her breast. Sobran, who had covered her with her own cloak, stood beside her with outward composure, holding her limp hand. Lievelin paced back and forth, his face pinched.
"Those poor souls outside, Lady Lenora."
Blood smeared his cheek.
"Sobran, I must return to the street and assist Captain Lintley. You stay with Sir Grant and Mistress Durian."
At once Sobran went to him.
"No,"
she grasped his elbows. "I command you to stay."
"Mine is as good a sword as any," the Evelyn told her.
"My royal guard, my knights of the body are also outside," Sobran cut in. "But if we die, their labours to protect us will be in vain. They will have to think of us as well as themselves."
The Evelyn framed her face in his hands.
"Sweeting," he said, "I will be all right." For the first time, Ead saw how deeply in love with Sobran he was, and it shook her.
"Damn you, you are my companion. You have shared my bed, my flesh, my heart."
Sobran snapped at him. Her face was taut, her voice ragged.
"And you will not leave our daughter fatherless, Albrecht Lievelin. You will not leave us here to mourn you."
His face twitched from one expression to another. Hope kindled a light in his eyes.
"Is it true?"
Holding his gaze, Sobran took his hands in hers and guided it to her belly.
"It is true," she said very softly.
Lievelin released a breath. A smile pulled at his mouth, and he stroked a thumb over her cheek.
"Then I am the most fortunate of all princes," he whispered, "and I swear to you
Our child will be the most beloved princess who ever lived. Breathing out, he gathered Sabran to his chest. My queen, my blessing, I will love you both until I am worthy of my good fortune.
You are already worthy. Sabran kissed his jaw. Do you not wear my love knot ring?
She set her chin on his shoulder. Her hand stroked up and down his back, and her eyes fluttered shut as he touched his lips to her temple. Whatever tension had been there was erased. A flame pressed into non-existence as the rift between their bodies closed. Fists hammered on the doors.
Sabran, a voice called. Majesty, it's Kate, with Margaret. Please let us in.
Kate, Meg. Sabran pulled away from Lievelin at once. Let them in, she barked at Lambrin. Make haste, Sir Grance. Too slow, he had heard the trick. It was not Lady Catrian Withy behind that door. It was an imitation, the mockery of a mimic. No, she said sharply. Stop.
How dare you countermand my orders? Sabran rounded on her. Who gave you authority?
She was flushed with anger, but he had kept her nerve. Majesty, it is not Catrian.
I think I should know her voice.
Sabran nodded to Lambrin. Let my ladies in, now. He was the knight of the body, so he obeyed. He had wasted no time. One of her knives was already slicing through the air when Lambrin unlocked the doors and someone crashed into the sanctuary. The intruder avoided whirling death. With one deft turn, fired a pistol at Lambrin, then pointed it at Iad. Lambrin collapsed with a peal of armor on stone. The bullet was buried between his eyes.
Don't move, Ursiri, a voice said. The pistol smoked. Put down that knife.
So you can kill my queen of Innis? Iad remained still. I would sooner you kept that pistol on my heart, but I suspect you only have one bullet, else all of us would be dead.
The cutthroat gave no answer. Who sent you? Sabran squared her shoulders. Who conspires to end the bloodline of the saint?
The cupbearer wishes you no ill, your majesty, except when you do not listen to reason, except when you lead Innis down paths it should not tread.
Cupbearer?
Paths, the woman continued, her voice muffled by the plague mask, that will lead Innis towards sin.
As the pistol snapped towards the royals, Iad threw her last knife. It struck the cutthroat through the heart just as the pistol fired. Sabran flinched. Iad closed the space between them and felt the moisture on her bodice, sick with dread. But there was no blood. The gown was still pristine. Behind them, Albrecht Lievelin dropped to one knee. His hands were at his doublet, where darkness was spreading.
Sabran, he murmured.
She turned.
No, she rasped. Albrecht!
He had watched, as if from a great distance, as the Queen of Innis ran to her companion and lowered him to the floor with her, gasping out his name as his heart's blood soaked into her skirts. As she held him close and pleaded with him to stay with her, even as he slipped away. As she doubled over him, cradling his head. As he grew still.
Albrecht?
Sabran looked up, her eyes overflowing.
Iad! Iad, help him, please!
Iad had no time to go to her. The doors opened again, and a second cutthroat stumbled into the sanctuary, heaving. At once, Iad divested the dead Lambrin of his sword and pinned the cutthroat to the wall.
Take off your mask, she bit out, or I swear to you I will take off the face beneath it.
Two gloved hands revealed a pale countenance. Trude Utziadur stared at the lifeless High Prince of Mentendon.
I never meant for him to die, she whispered. I only wanted to help you, your majesty. I only wanted you to listen.
Chapter 27 East
Nicolay's ruse was conniving, and it was a plan so dangerous and unflinching that he almost wondered if he really had come up with it, eternal coward that he was. He was going to make the elixir and buy his way back to the west if it killed him, and it very well might. To escape Orisima for good and to breathe life back into his work, he needed to take a risk. He needed what Eastern law had denied him. He needed blood from a dragon to see how gods renewed themselves, and he knew just where to start. The servants were busy in the kitchen.
What help can we be, learned Dr. Roos? One asked when Nicolay's appeared in the doorway.
I need to send a message.
Before Nicolaes could lose the speck of courage that remained to him, he held out the letter.
It must reach the honoured Lady Tanny at the Saltflower Castle before sunset. Will you take it to the post riders for me?
Yes, learned Dr. Roos, it will be done.
Do not tell them who sent it, he added quietly.
She looked uncertain, but promised she would not. He handed her money enough to pay a post rider, and she left. All he could do now was wait. Fortunately, waiting meant more time to read. While Izaru was at the market and Perume was tending to patients, Nicolaes sat in his room, the bobtail cat purring beside him, and perused The Price of Gold, his favourite text on alchemy. His copy was well worn. As he turned to a new chapter that afternoon, a sliver of delicate silk fluttered out. His breath caught. He retrieved the fragment from the floor and smoothed it out before the cat could claw it to shreds. It had been years since he had last brought himself to look at the greatest mystery of his life. Most of the books and documents in his possession had once belonged to Janot, who had bequeathed half of his library to Nicolaes, as well as his armillary sphere, a lacustrine candle clock, and a host of other curiosities. There had been many beautiful tomes in the collection, illuminated manuscripts, rare tracts, miniature prayer books, but nothing had obsessed Nicolaes more than this tiny scrap of silk. Not because it was brushed with a language he could not decipher, and not because it was clearly very old, but because in attempting to unlock its secret, Janot had lost his life. Aladdin, his widow, had given it to Trude, who had mourned for her grandfather by fixating on his possessions. The child had kept the fragment in a locket for a year. Just before Nicolaes had left for Innes, Trude had come to his house in Brigstad. She had worn a little ruff, and her hair, Janot's hair, had curled around her shoulders. "Uncle Nicolaes," she had said gravely, "I know you are leaving soon. My lord grandsire was holding this piece of paper when he died. I have tried to work out what it says, but the petty school has not taught me enough." She had offered it with a gloved hand. "Papa says you are very clever. I think you will be able to work out what the writing means."
"This belongs to you, child," he had said, even as he ached to take it. "Your lady grandmother gave it to you.
I think it was supposed to be for you. I would like you to have it. Only write to me and tell me if you work out what it means."
He had never been able to send her good news. Based on the script and material, the fragment was certainly from the ancient East, but that was all Janot had gleaned from it at the time of his death. Years had passed, and still Nicolaes did not know why he had been clutching it on his deathbed. He rolled it now, carefully, and slotted it into the ornate case Izaru had gifted him. He dried his eyes, breathed in deeply, and opened The Price of Gold once again. That evening, Nicolaes supped with Izaru and Perume before feigning sleep. As night fell, he crept from his room and put on a hat that belonged to Izaru. Then he stole into the dark. He knew his way to the beach. Evading the sentinels, he hurried past the night markets, head down and cane in hand. There were no lanterns to betray his arrival on the beach. It was empty of everyone but her. Tane Madushi waited beside a rock pool. The brim of a helm cast her face into a shadow. Nicolaes sat at a distance.
"You honour me with your presence, Lady Tanne."
It was some time before she answered.
"You speak Saikanese?" "Of course. What do you want?"
"A favour."
"I owe you no favours."
Her voice was cold and soft.
"I could kill you here."
"I suspected you might threaten me, which is why I left a note about your crime with the learned Dr. Moyaka." "A lie, but she had no way of knowing that."
"His household is asleep now, but if I do not return to burn that note, all of them will know what you have done. I doubt the Sea General will allow you to keep your place among the riders, you, who might have let the red sickness into Psyche. You misjudge what I would do to keep their place."
Nicolaes chuckled.
"You left an innocent man and a young woman to die in the shit and piss of a jailhouse, also your special ceremony would go just as you wanted," he reminded her. "No, Lady Tanne, I have not misjudged you. I feel as if I know you very well."
She was quiet for some time. Then,
You said young woman?
Of course, she could have no idea.
I doubt you care for poor Sulliard, Nicolay said, but your friend from the theatre was arrested too. I shudder to think what they might have done to draw your name from her.
You are lying,